In episode 14 of MobiCast, John and Chris explain why you should stop worrying about cloud lock-in. Welcome to MobiCast, a weekly conversation about containerization, Docker, and modern software deployment. Let's jump right in.
Welcome, Chris and Rich. It's another MobiCast.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
Good to hear your voices. We've got a lot to talk about this week. I wanted to cover a little bit that we left on the table last week and also some new stuff. So we're going to skip with the fun part where we talk about what we did this week and just jump right in. So last week, we talked about serverless and we mostly spent our time talking about Lambda. And then after we finished recording, I was like, hey, Chris, I don't really know anything about Fargate, but it sounded really exciting. Chris, let me just say that to you again, but this time on air. Chris, I don't really know anything about Fargate, but it sounds exciting. Are we going to start using that?
That's an interesting question, John. I haven't heard that one before. It's interesting, because it definitely builds on the whole serverless thing. Fargate is essentially a serverless ECS. So currently with, ECS is the orchestration platform, offered by Amazon for running your Docker containers on a cluster of EC2 nodes. We use that quite heavily, and given that all of our software runs in containers, Fargate is something relatively new. It was announced at reInvent this past November. Had been in beta for a while. It's now actually it's now live in multiple regions. And what it is it's basically all the benefits of ECS, but you no longer have to manage your cluster nodes anymore. It's basically here's my container, and AWS, you take care of it. You find the hardware for it. You run my container, and I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about like scaling out a cluster or patching my servers or anything like that. So
that sounds awesome. Why don't we just do that?
So it does sound awesome if those kind of problems that it solves were like actual real big problems. And I would just say from the experience of having used ECS in production now for 2.5 years, I think it is, I can say that one of the great benefits of ECS and containers in general has been that like the actual management overhead of dealing with your cluster resources is actually really minimal. I'm now at the point where I probably spend maybe once a month or maybe every other month doing some maintenance on my ECS, the cluster resources. It's very little overhead. So there's a little bit of time to get it set up, but even getting it set up, like once you just understand the details of how to do that, it's like it's a half a day to go from zero to hero with ECS, right? So as another example, like last week we have four different clusters set up in ECS, all with many host nodes inside each one of those clusters. Wanted to upgrade to the latest AMIs to bring in new security patches, also get new ECS agent software on there, and then swap out some of our some of the stuff that we do in initialization of host and our user data script. So I ended up kind of making those changes. I basically shot every single one of those hosts in the head, rebuilt brand new ones, spun them all up. And that was probably a total of 4 hours to rebuild four clusters with brand new machines with all the latest and greatest. So I don't know, 4 hours every 2 months, not much in the way of investment. And then the benefits of running your own ECS clusters are, one, it's definitely more economical. So Fargate is definitely, for the most part, it's going to be more expensive using Fargate than it is running it on your own ECS cluster hardware.
Which blew my mind when you said that, because I thought, wait, if Amazon gets to decide how they use their hardware and they don't give you any access to it, then shouldn't that be cheaper? Can't they do some optimizations that lower prices? But apparently not.
Yeah, and who knows what the strategy is for pricing and whether this reflects the actual cost for them and it actually is more expensive that for them to offer it this way. Or if they're kind of viewing this as like, hey, we're adding more value here and right. This is worth a premium, right? So we're pricing at a premium. So time will tell whether, you know, pricing comes down and that inflection point happens where it's actually more affordable to run on Fargate than it is on your own dedicated hardware. But you can also do great things like your EC2, your ECS clusters can take advantage of spot instances and reserved instances. So there's lots of stuff you can do there. I'm sure that like if cost is your issue, you're going to win out using a normal ECS as opposed to Fargate. You also have a lot more control and insight over like just the service capabilities of what's running on. So like, you know, do you have warm up time when spinning up containers in Fargate, kind of like you do in Lambda? Are you queued behind other folks? Like, is it other services? So like, are you going to get kind of a more jagged kind of response time pattern to your jobs versus if you're running your own cluster, like you know exactly what's kind of running on there and you can kind of you have much more insight into that. There's also issues with, you know, just application architecture and sidecar containers and logging and making sure all that works. And it's just for the time being, it feels like a lot of that, you just have a lot more control. It's a lot easier. It's a lot more integrated when you're running it on your own ECS cluster as opposed to Fargate.
So this is that was like a downright commercial for ECS. We should get some primetime spot and put it on there. but that is a good segue into the next rest of our conversation, which I think I'll call How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Cloud Lock-In and Just Do My Job. So ECS is obviously it's very specific to Amazon, AWS. And if you use it, you know, you're a little bit locked in and all the other things that you might use on AWS lock you in further and further. But when I was at GlueCon a few weeks ago, it was weird. You know, I brought this up a few weeks in a couple of podcasts ago, but I just could not have a conversation with anybody that worked at a company of any size whatsoever and not have the idea of cloud lock-in come into the conversation. I was not even, I'm not interested in talking about cloud lock-in, but somehow everybody was talking about it. Every single talk featured it in some way. All these companies were talking about how they had features that in their products that help prevent cloud lock-in. And it was just like, might as well call it the cloud lock-in conf. So I don't know, just to get to this conversation a little bit and go a little deeper, maybe Chris, when we talked about this before, you talked about one of the ways that people arrive at the cloud and leave the cloud. So maybe you can tell us that story again.
Sure. Yeah. I would say, you know, for the most part, when starting out, so whether you're a startup or kind of a new group with inside of a bigger company, taking advantage of cloud makes a lot of sense because it's you very quick startup time. You know, you can have servers up and running in a matter of minutes as opposed to months if you have to go buy your own. And also just from a cost standpoint, it's so much more economical to run that workload in the cloud. And, you know, running in the cloud, you also get a lot of value-added services, all the various integration points and just all the features that are offered by all the modern cloud providers. So it ends up being a pretty fertile place to you know, get going, ramp up, get to a level of scale. And I think for a lot of folks, like they never get beyond, like they never get to the point where it's like they've been so successful, they've grown so much where it now makes sense for them to think about getting off the cloud. Because there is an inflection point. At some point, you scale up enough, you're using enough resources in the cloud where you're now overpaying. And it's going to be much cheaper for you to actually to run it yourself, to go buy those servers and to have your own data center and to run it on-prem. Mm-hmm. So that's that inflection point. So if you do get successful enough, if you're running, you know, enough requests through your system, you have a high enough load to justify it, then that's when you take that hard look at it and say, you know what, it's time to have our migration strategy to start moving this off of the cloud and onto our own on-prem data center. But again, like we talked about before, like if you're at that point, you're so successful, the capital is there, and the financial incentive is there that you'll do it, right? It's hard work. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, you know, and it's going to take a while, but like the financial incentive is there, the capital's there, you're going to do it. So don't worry about lock in from the get go, because it just complicates everything. And chances are it's not going to be an issue for you. And if it is, then that's actually a great thing, and you should be right. Really happy about it.
Right. And from that perspective, you know, cloud lock-in doesn't really matter, because no matter which cloud you might have chosen, getting off the cloud, there's no AWS on-prem or Google Cloud on-prem or Azure on-prem. Like, you literally have to decouple yourself from whichever cloud you chose. So you've got to do that work no matter what. No strategy of putting yourself on both Google and AWS would have helped you.
Yes, correct. Yeah, correct. There's a little bit of blending there where AWS does have some stuff where like you can actually run their software on-prem, but it always requires that tie-in. Like you're still, at the end of the day, you're giving money to AWS, and mm-hmm. so to actually be fully divested from that, and yeah, obviously you have to come up with that yourself.
And so then there's another path. So that Chris just talked about the path where you're maybe a startup or you're a young company and you start in the cloud. And then there's this other path that I was seeing quite a bit at GlueCon, which is, you know, lots of telecommunications companies, cable companies, healthcare companies, big companies, big, you know, kind of monopolistic almost types of companies where they've been on-prem forever. And then they started to get really awful at it. Like, now it takes weeks to requisition a new server. Putting up in a new environment is just like a headache involving 15 layers of management. They just can't get anything done. And so they see the cloud as a way to get back to some level of agility. And I think this does tend to affect a certain kind of company that maybe is not facing very much competition in their market, and they are able to get to this point without getting crushed by competitors that are more nimble and agile. But, you know, these companies, they might be CenturyLink type companies or Charter Communications type companies. Now they want to get on the cloud, and management all up and down the line is saying, well, make sure we don't get locked in. We don't want to have that happen to us again. And I wasn't sure. They a lot of people had talked about being burned before. I should have dug more in. It was just kind of a matter of me not even being that interested in cloud lock-in and kind of realizing later that every conversation had involved it. I don't know how they actually got burned before. Like, you're still here. You're making a lot of money. How is it that you were burned from some kind of lock-in in the past? Do you have any guesses of what that might have been, Chris? I mean, I'm just speculating at this point. You will be too.
I would guess that it's just vendor lock-in in general, right? So like, mm-hmm. these are all companies with probably long histories, lots of IT. They've gone through many cycles of technology and dealt with many vendors, and they've just the length of time. Absolutely, they've worked with vendors before that then go belly up, right? And then they have to scramble. So this is very much a strategy for reducing risk, right? Don't have a single dependency, have backups, multiple vendors providing that particular functionality that you need, so that if one does go away or if one does, you know, raise prices to a level that you're not comfortable with, then you have options. So I think probably that's where that's coming from.
Brian, I think you're right. So let's crush that notion.
Hey, this is Rich. You might recognize me as the guy who introduces the show, but is pretty much silent during the meat of the podcast. The truth is, these topics are oftentimes incredibly complex, and I'm just too inexperienced to provide much value. What you might not know is that John and Chris created the training product to help developers of all skill sets get caught up to speed on AWS and Docker. If you're like me and feel underwater in these conversations, head on over to prodockertraining.com and get on the mailing list for the inaugural course. Okay, let's dive back in.
What is more, in your opinion, Chris, what is more risky? Having a strategy of deploying to multiple clouds with the same functionality or picking a cloud for those types of companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think just for almost any company, I think like the idea of like building a system that can actually run in a hybrid cloud environment is so complicated. It's so much overhead, and chances are it's not going to work optimally. It definitely won't work optimally. I'm very skeptical of that. And whether it works at all, even if it works adequately, would be a challenge in and of itself, I think. So I would say there's probably a lot of risk there, as opposed to, you know, just forget about, like, these companies are so big that I think that the two concerns might be, okay, pricing is going to be so unfavorable that like it feels like robbery, or they're just not going to be available anymore. They're going to go out of business. And so I think you just have to look at your cloud provider and really ask yourself, like, how likely is that going to happen? So Amazon as a company, they don't make much money, right? Like they've definitely prioritized on growing their market. They're going to make money based upon volume. So their idea is land and expand. I don't see a lot of risk in them saying, okay, you know, we're going to go and double, triple, quadruple pricing for folks, you know, type thing. It just does not feel like that's in their DNA and kind of what they're, sure, what they're trying to do. And it would harm their business. They would see a dramatic downturn. And for them, it's all about scale, right? Like they're making such huge investments in data centers and computer equipment and whatnot. If they see a fall off in usage, then they have a bunch of stuff just sitting around not being used. And that's fairly costly. So it's not going to behoove them to go raise prices and alienate customers. And then for them, like going out of business, like really, again, like ask yourself, like, how likely is that to happen? If AWS went out of business, forget it. Like our economy has just collapsed. Like there's much bigger problems than your company, right? At that point.
Right.
I mean, it literally, like, it's, that would be like, I mean, just think about that. Like if AWS went away, like what would happen? Like it would be like the equivalent of like just setting off a bomb, you know, in a major financial center or something like that.
Yeah. And just to pick on one thing that you talked about there a minute ago, you said, you know, it can't run optimally. So I just started to imagine, what might you try to architect that's multi-cloud, that runs across cloud? So the first thing that came to my mind was, well, maybe you have some microservices and they're in Node.js and you put them on Kubernetes clusters and you've got a Kubernetes cluster over in Google Cloud and another one in AWS. And then the first thing that came to my mind is, well, where's the database? If you're going to have a persistent store, is that going to be on the AWS side or is it going to be on the Google side? Whichever it's on, the other one is not going to be able, you know, is going to suffer from some latency issues. So that was one thought that occurred to me. And then the other thought that occurred to me was, okay, well, so let's say, you know, we say each microservice has to live in its own cloud. So, but we're going to sprinkle our microservices around. So these two microservices will be on Google and these two microservices will be on AWS. Again, if those microservices need to talk to each other, there could be some weirdness and latency issues and you won't get to take advantage of certain security things that you get like VPCs and things like that. But also, now you just have to have teams that are knowledgeable about both. I mean, at one level, it may seem like it's just compute and it's just, you know, DNS and load balancing. But each one of those clouds, even if you're using Terraform, you have to know that, you know, you have to know something about the API, something about how to navigate the management console, something about specifically how it works and how monitoring works and everything. Like you've just more, you know, more than doubled the requirements on your staff in terms of what they need to understand in terms of how their infrastructure runs.
Absolutely. Like you touched on, I mean, there's just multiple facets there of like the complexity of saying, I want to run in a hybrid cloud environment. So it's application architecture is big. It becomes a big issue. Like, how do I do that? For some of the exact same scenarios you just talked about, there is the operational ability of it. Like, monitoring is going to be different in Azure than it's going to be in AWS, right? So sure. You have to kind of build that abstraction on top of that to give you that insight as a whole. And then you have all these cloud providers, like totally different, right? Like, I'm 7+ years of AWS experience and I'm still trying to keep up and learn about AWS. Like, throw Azure on that and throw Google Cloud on that. And it's like, whoa, that's a lot, right? Like, you need to hire more people. So,
right.
It's an all in the name of saying, like, I'm not going to be locked into a cloud provider. Like, that's when you have to kind of take a step back and say, what's the worst evil here? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, having said all this and having made a strong case, I think that we shouldn't be worried about cloud lock-in. There is a reality that people are, and as fascinating as we might be and as persuasive as we might try to be, we can't convince them to not worry about this. So, and companies are putting it, you know, at the top of the list of things that they're concerned about. So I think that just realizing that this is happening and realizing that this is a hot topic is kind of important. And I think it'll have an interesting effect on the market. You know, my opinion is that this will have a commoditizing effect on the market. And I think we're already seeing it today. It'll make APIs more standard across clouds. It'll make the names of things and the hierarchies of features more standard. So it could have overall benefits to everyone, this market pressure. Your thoughts, Chris?
Maybe, although in this landscape with AWS being the clear leader, and they know that both Google and Microsoft are, you know, breathing down their neck. They want to try to get a market share on them. I just don't see how, like, Amazon sees it to their advantage to kind of work together with those to facilitate that stuff. So I just see people like Amazon innovating faster and faster and the others playing catch up, right? And so to then try to have kind of like industry standards for these things to interoperate, like, it becomes an intractable problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also a good way of looking at it. So yeah, we'll have this conversation again a year from now and see what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably good. I think we can wrap it up with that. Maybe let me give you one more chance to kind of put a cap on it, Chris.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, maybe the takeaway is definitely, my suggestion would be, don't worry about cloud lock-in. It's when it becomes an issue, like, it's, you're going to have the resources to go deal with that. The other thing, like, if it really is like something that's concerning and you need it, just as part of organizational buy-off, I think maybe the best approach to that would be to use the proper level abstraction such that you can have a backup data center in a different cloud provider. So don't try to run it concurrently. Instead, just go build your application for one and have it hosted in one cloud provider. Know what things that are cloud specific that you are using. Those are the things that you would then look at abstracting out, so that if you did need to say, okay, I'm not using that cloud provider, I'm going to another one, you could do it. But that would be, again, like, it's a lot of work. But if that's what you need from an organizational standpoint, then that would be my suggestion for going about it.
Great. Yeah, great suggestion. And thanks again. This has been a fun one. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Later.
Well, dear listener, you made it to the end. We appreciate your time and invite you to continue the conversation with us online. This episode, along with show notes and other valuable resources, is available at mobicast.fm/14. If you have any questions or additional insights, we encourage you to leave us a comment there. Thank you, and we'll see you again next week.